Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
A few years back, I was at a Catholic event at which the organizer had the grand idea of trying to efficiently serve food. So, of course, there's a buffet line. The problem was that the event was so large that the buffet line itself wrapped around the room seemingly several times. And I had the fortune or the misfortune of being stuck at a point in the line where the people in front of me already knew each other and they were having a conversation. And there was someone behind me who was very, very socially awkward. So since I also am socially awkward, this was an awkward fest. And what was even more awkward was that the woman behind me informed me that she was a media studies major. So I asked her what she did, and her description was something like she watched the news and paid attention to different forms. And so I awkwardly said, "Ah, you dedicate yourself to the news, and I dedicate myself to the olds." And unlike your response, which is what I was fishing for, she just gave me an awkward stare. So because I'm a philosopher, I gave an unasked for explanation. I said, "You look for the newest change. I look for what never changes." More blank stare. And so I thought, all right, well, I'm on a roll, so I might as well just dig in. So I said, "I've been on a news fast for 18 months. And at that point, I didn't get a blank stare. I got a look of contempt. Ooh, yes. So this talk, we might say, had its beginnings back while I was standing in the buffet line having that awkward conversation. In other words, what I'm intrigued by was this attitude that somehow stepping back from a kind of technology, or at least the product of a kind of technology, that would be morally reprehensible. I offer this anecdote not only to get you laughing, but also to let it be a warning to you, a double warning. First, that I give unasked for explanations and I do other unintentionally awkward things. The second warning is that both because I'm a philosopher and because I am still on my news fast, I won't be telling you anything that is new. So I mean this in two senses. First off, I won't be offering any new statistics about technology or our use of it. I can point you, if you're interested, to some fascinating reads on this, but all of the things that I've read are already out of date because they're more than a year old. Also, I'm going to be saying things that aren't new in the respect that I won't be asking any of the new questions that have been asked recently. At the risk of whetting your appetite for those questions while not indulging it, I want to name some of the newer questions that I won't be asking. And the reason why I won't ask these is because either the questions have answers that are obvious and straightforward, or else someone else has already answered them better than I could. So here's one. Can technology be used to achieve good outcomes? Obviously, yes. Can we use technology with good intentions, even if the outcomes are bad? Obviously, yes. Does technology make it more difficult to live in moral purity? Obviously, yes. Are social media platforms and smartphones addictive? Obviously, yes. Would we be happier if we went off the grid? Probably. If we survived. Will AI take over the world? Probably not. But someone who uses AI will. Or someone who programs AI already has taken over the world. Maybe. Okay. The old question that I will take up is this. Does our use of technology hasten the death of wisdom? Put slightly more softly, does our use of technology make it more difficult for us to become wise? This is an old question, both in the sense that it examines technology through a lens that was very popular in olden years, not to say decades ago, but centuries and even millennia ago. This asks a question about technology with respect to its effect on wisdom. This also is an old question in that this very particular question was already asked long ago. And I don't know if this is a break of my news fast, but Google told me that it was asked 2,395 years ago by Plato in the Phaedrus. Plato records a conversation between Thamis, the king of the Egyptians, and Theuth, who is a visiting god, kind of peddling his wares to the Egyptian king and trying to convince the king that he should accept these gifts. So the god Theuth comes to the king of the Egyptians and offers writing as a tool. Theuth promises that writing will improve the memory and the wisdom of the Egyptians. Thamis, who himself is quite wise, says that he will reject the gift because the effect of using writing will have the opposite end as what Theuth promises. He says, people will become forgetful. They'll rely on external signs and not on their own internal resources. Also, people will acquire the reputation for wisdom without the reality. They'll be thought to be wise because they have words, but the possession of those words will mask their ignorance. So, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to read to you the rest of the Phaedrus. Just kidding. But why not? Two reasons why not. First off, Plato doesn't explain his answer. He just asserts it and then leaves you to deal with the drama of sorting it out. The second reason why it's not enough just to read the Phaedrus is because none of you are here, none of us are here, because you are curious to know whether or not the use of technology does hasten the death of wisdom. The answer is obvious, or at least a softer version of the question, that it makes it more difficult, that's obvious. The question that I'm suspecting, or I hope, brought you here, and it's the question that definitely brought me here, is this. If we know that our use of technology makes it more difficult for us to be wise, why are we still using technology in that way? This is a specific form of a more general question, which is, why do we keep doing the things that we know are bad? Socrates and Aristotle both have an explanation for that question. Socrates says, the reason why you keep doing what you know is bad is because you don't really know it's bad. It's a problem of ignorance. Aristotle says, nah, you know it's bad. You're just weak. So, in this talk, we have two potential targets, weakness and ignorance. Unfortunately, I can't do anything to make myself, much less you, stronger over the course of this talk. But what I can do is point to things that we're doing that are making us remain weak. And then as far as the ignorance part, I don't know if I'll tell you anything that you don't already know, but what I can do is redirect your attention to what you know so that it might sink in more deeply. So I'm putting forth this thesis. The sunny version of the thesis is, if we change how we use what I'm going to call technocratic tools, we can prevent, or at least forestall, the death of wisdom. The doomsday version of my thesis is this. Unless each of us individually changes how we use technocratic tools, we will be incapable of becoming wise, and we won't care. So you can choose which version you like. I'll present this thesis in four parts. And each part is going to be a series of observations that is just loosely tied together into an argument. Part one will examine what wisdom is and what wisdom looks like in action. Part two will look at what a tool is generally, and then why technocratic tools merit our special attention. Part three will examine our use of technocratic tools and how it affects our ability to engage in those activities that are central to wisdoming, as it were. And then part four will be some suggestions for what we might do if we don't wish to hasten the death of wisdom. Part one, what is wisdom? Since the account of wisdom that I'm going to be expounding here is drawn from St. Thomas and Aristotle, and since both Thomas and Aristotle ground their philosophy in experience, I propose we begin with an experience. And this will also be kind of Socratic, because I'm going to tell you that you already know what wisdom is because you've already had experience of it. So suppose you want to throw a barbecue for your friends. You decide on a barbecue because Lent is coming and you know that people are going to be sick of fish fries. So you say, let's go for a barbecue. And since there are, well, maybe there aren't deer wandering around just outside the auditorium, at least in this general area. This is venison country, right? Okay. They are outside? Oh, dear. All right. Those aren't the kind that you want to eat, though, right? No. Okay. All right. So you want to throw a barbecue for some friends. How do you go about making this wish of yours come to life? First, you consider some possible means to bringing about the barbecue. How do you get the barbecue? Is this the region where barbecue is a verb or a noun? Or both? You don't know? Both? Okay. All right. So you're not looking for a grill. You're looking for, you know, the meat stuff. Okay. So you consider some possible means. You could purchase some from a local. You could go hunting on your own, like be really local. You could buy some from Walmart. You could ask people to bring their own barbecue. Like, come to a barbecue. It's a potluck. Or suppose you're like, well, maybe if it just has barbecue sauce on it, then it's barbecue. So maybe you could buy some tofu, smother it in barbecue sauce, and call it barbecue. Okay. Feel free to react as your gut inclines you. By the way, I am sensing some. Not all of you are hampering your or tamping down your responses, and I appreciate those of you who aren't. Okay. All right. So you have a list of possible means, but how do you narrow down these means? This was happening as I was mentioning the means. You were already doing this. You call to mind some rules that you're already aware of. That's to say, some shoulds and shouldn'ts with respect to throwing a party, and specifically maybe a barbecue. So those of you who were grimacing openly when I mentioned certain things, you were grimacing because you were judging one of those means according to a rule that you already had. So here's my attempt at articulating the rules for throwing a barbecue. I, who am from Connecticut. All right. You shouldn't give people what will make them sick. You shouldn't give people what they clearly don't like. You should, when possible, support your local over a centralized institution. You shouldn't go over budget. You shouldn't take so much time in planning the party that you neglect your duties, even if you really would like some distraction from your studying. And you shouldn't pass the buck off to other people when it's tough. Okay, so you have a list of rules and you have a list of means. As you're trying to make a decision, you have to somehow apply these rules to the means. If we were to run through each of the means individually, it'd be something like this. Buying from the local joint is going to be expensive. So that meets the you shouldn't go over budget. Hunting, doing it on your own, is really time consuming and you probably should be studying. So that also doesn't meet all the rules. Tofu is soy, to which many people are allergic. And even if they're not allergic, then they might pretend to be allergic because they don't like it. So the potluck idea seems like you're passing the buck. So that also doesn't mean anything. And then also, Walmart barbecue isn't exactly what people want. What are you going to do? None of the means that you've come up with meet all of the rules. So at this point, what do you do? I propose to you that you've already done what the prudent or the wise person does in this situation. In other words, you try to figure out which of the rules is the greatest. So you try to figure out which is the one that I should definitely not break. And if any of the means breaks that one, then that's completely off the table. So maybe you're not sure which of these rules is the greatest, but at least you know which ones you can figure out which of the means is the least bad, since nothing completely meets all the rules. So you judge that it is worse to make people sick than to disappoint them slightly. So you go to Walmart. Okay. All right. Let's zoom out from this experience and consider, what were the psychological activities that were in play as you were doing your barbecue planning? As a preliminary, you were wishing for something good. That's to say, you not only wished for a good outcome, like a great party, but you also wished to achieve that good outcome in a good way. You didn't want to make your friends gag, and you also didn't want to make yourself gag morally. Okay, so you had a good wish. Subsequent to your wishing, you then generated a list of means, and in that process, you actually coordinated an amazing complex of more fundamental activities. In order to generate that list of ways of providing barbecue for your friends, you had to recall past experiences. You had to imagine future possibilities, and then you also had to pay attention to the present conditions. So you had to recall, what is it like eating food from Walmart? What is it like seeing people gag on tofu? What is it like planning a party really because you just don't want to study? So you have all these past experiences, and then you also have the ability of imagining future possibilities. So you have ability to project something like the past into the future. Prior to judging all of the means, to figuring which ones are best, you also had to draw up in mind those rules that you should follow. I don't really know how it is that we draw up those rules, but one thing that I think is worth asking is, how did you figure out that those were rules in the first place? The elemental psychological activities that are involved in this are noticing similarities in your experience. In other words, you notice similar situations that succeed, that are good, and you figure out what is it that all these good things had in common. So you can say that one of the ways that we identify what you should do is just by noticing when things go well and then figuring out the pattern. And then we make that pattern into a kind of a rule. So once again, we have these psychological abilities of noticing not only how things are similar, but then also articulating similar patterns throughout those. Lastly, psychological activity that was in play is that you had to apply these rules to the means. You had to not only have the list of rules on the one hand and the list of means on the other, but you had to see them together. I had an experience of this when I was in my first years of being in the convent. This actually wasn't me, but it was one of the sisters I entered with, who actually is from barbecue country. In the convent, we have the delightful practice of having one sister ring the rising bell. So the rising bell is like an old style schoolhouse bell through which you cannot sleep. You really can't. And this relieves all 300 other sisters of the obligation of setting an alarm or anything like this. It's delightful. So, except when it's rung at 5 o'clock in the morning, which is the typical. All right, so this sister knew that she was supposed to ring at 5 o'clock. That's the rule. You ring at 5, right? Not at 5:05, not at 6:05, and not at 3 a.m. So she's supposed to ring at 5. Now, this is her first time ringing the bell for the entire house, and she was rather nervous. So up until 5 a.m., she awakened every hour on the hour. just as sort of, you know, in preparation. She looked at her watch, and it said 2:59, and the bell was across the house. So she, and I was in the room where she started running, she ran to the bell, because, of course, she's watching only the minute hand. And now she has in her mind the rule that you should ring at 5. And she's also, with her eyes, watching the clock. And something in her, she recognized as she was watching that it's about to turn 3 o'clock. But something in her didn't see the union of these two things, the rule about what you should do and the fact that this is not in accordance with the rule. So she rang at 3 a.m. And then what happens? Well, you go through the entire convent saying, go back to bed. All right, so I tell this anecdote because there's something in addition to just having the rules and noticing what's happening right now. There's a kind of unification of these two. We can just call that the application of a principle to the particular. And that's a complex psychological process. All right. Here is the gloriously concise and precise Thomistic Aristotelian account of wisdom that we've just seen unfold first in the experience and then second in my description of the psychological activities. To be wise is to know the order of reality. That's to say, to have a vision of how all things hang together as a whole and how each particular thing fits into that whole. If we have a vision of the whole as ordered, we can then in turn live an ordered life. Wisdom, that's to say, has two expressions. We have speculative wisdom, by means of which we know the order of things, knowing which ones are more foundational for others, and which are the absolute greatest of things. Then we have practical wisdom, which allows us to order our actions in a way that doesn't conflict with the order of reality. Practical wisdom, that's to say, applies to our action speculative wisdom. This application of speculative wisdom to particulars is called not only practical wisdom, but it's also called prudence. And then even more simply, we can call it choosing well. We choose well when we perform each of the component activities of choosing well. The component activities, as Aristotle identifies them, are 3. Aristotle identifies choosing as a voluntary act that begins with a wish, proceeds with deliberation, and ends in an action. Thomas will refine this a little bit, but I want to walk through just briefly those. We choose well when we wish well, meaning we want something that is good that we don't yet have. We want not just the things that are given to us already, but we actually bother to wish. We bother to want for more than what we have. What we wish for, in other words, what we want, is something we can call it an end goal, or we can just call it a goal or an end. It's just something that we desire. Deliberating is the process of examining and then evaluating possible means to our wished for end. We deliberate about the potential steps that we could take to that end. And it's those steps, those means, that bring us closer to the end that we're wishing for. And here, St. Thomas refines what Aristotle just calls deliberation. Thomas will say, in the process of deliberating, it begins with inquiry, or he says, sometimes he'll say, taking counsel. So in other words, in order to generate the means toward the end, we have to first either take counsel by consulting our experience or the experience of others. And we have to inquire, or we have to take counsel into not only the means, but also the principles that we ought to follow. St. Thomas then says, after we've inquired, we need to judge. We need to unite those principles to the means. So that's the application. Then lastly, after we have deliberated about the best means, after we've done that, we act on them. You don't act directly for the end. You act for the end by willing the means. St. Thomas elaborates here that there are many reasons why we can fail to act on the means. And here, these are what he lists as the vices that are contrary to prudence. He says we can fail to act on something that we have identified by acting precipitately. In other words, we might not even bother taking counsel or finding all of the means. We might just act on something that we haven't really considered. We also might consider all the means and consider all of the principles, but we might not bother judging them very well. We don't bother uniting them. Or we might do all those things, but because we're afraid of the pain that will be involved in acting, we say, well, let me go back to the drawing board. Let me think again. Let me second guess. And I'm going to second guess my second guessing. So there's a kind of internal procrastination that we can do just in our deliberation that will forestall it, just doing the thing. Okay, so to avoid those things is to be wise. All right, shifting gears to part two. What is a tool, and what kind of tool am I most concerned about? What I'm calling a tool, in general, is anything that is external to us that we use to accomplish an activity and that removes or extends a natural limit that we otherwise would have. So, a mirror is a tool, but our power of sight is not a tool, because the power of sight is internal to us, but a mirror is external. A mirror extends our power of sight beyond our natural limit. It's rather unnatural to look at your own face. Also, shoes are tools, but not our feet. So both of them assist walking, but shoes allow us to walk, well, in theory, they allow us to walk farther without pain than if we were just walking around finding urban venison in the snow, right? All right, so that's tool in general. Rather than just telling you directly about the tool that I'm most concerned about, I'm going to play one of my most favorite philosophical games, which I call buckets. And this is a version of the other not well-known philosophical game, namely, there are two kinds of people. So these are just sorting games. And I'll say that my favorite iteration of there are two kinds of people is there are people that think there are two kinds of people, and then there are people that don't, right? Okay, so buckets is what I'll do is I will take all tools and I'm going to sort them into buckets. Then I'll dump those buckets out and sort them again. I'm going to do this 8 times. It'll be fast. But my intention in doing this is to, I'll begin with the buckets that I care the least about, and I'll end up with the buckets that I care the most about. My intention in doing this, other than just to entertain you, is to let you know the kinds of tools that I don't really care about. So I want to acknowledge that there are different ways of looking at tools and different reasons to be concerned about tools, but I want to refine which ones I'm concerned about. Okay, so here it goes. Number 8, there are tools that require a non-human power source, such as electricity or batteries, versus those that don't. So you have your electric toothbrush, and then you have floss. Number 7, there are tools that assist us in using other tools versus tools that assist us in non-tooled activities. So you have a phone cover. This one looks like a cinder block, doesn't it? you have a phone cover, which is a tool for a tool. And then you have the tool itself, which assists something that isn't tooled, namely speaking, or throwing my voice farther. Number 6, we have artificial tools and natural tools. An example of an artificial tool, a wooden cart used to move heavy stuff over a distance. Example of a natural tool, a tree branch used to swing over a creek or a crick. Just an aside here, artificial tools come into existence only when we make them, but natural tools exist and have a purpose of their own, even when we're not using them as tools. Number 5, there are smart tools versus dumb tools. Smart tools adjust aspects of their activity based on how they're used, whereas dumb tools have just rigid activity. A horse is a smart tool. So is ChatGPT, right? Okay. A belt is a dumb tool. It does the same thing. Well, actually, I've been wearing this one for over 20 years, and it's kind of contoured itself to the fact that I wear my rosary on this side, but it's not a constant adjustment. So there we go. It's dumb. Number four, there are tools that are designed to assist or accomplish physical activities, like escalators, versus tools that are designed to help us accomplish mental activities, like writing. Number three, there are tools that make an activity easier versus tools that make an activity possible. A broom makes it easier for us to do what we could do without a broom. So we could, in theory, sweep this stage with our hands, with our tongue. It would be gross. But when you really think of it, the broom doesn't allow you to do anything that you couldn't already do, maybe even better with your hand, if you were willing to wash your hand. On the other hand, there is a microscope or a telescope, which makes it possible to do something that we couldn't do without the microscope or the telescope. Okay, number two, there are tools that are aimed at useful activities and tools that are aimed at useless but pleasant activities. So an example of a useful tool would be a toothbrush. An example of a tool that's aimed at a useless activity would be a violin. You might think that you need the violin, but there really is never a need when you're like, oh shoot, I forgot the violin. Well, maybe, okay, you know. There's no absolute need for violins. And that's not a bad thing. Some fun words to describe these two different kinds of activities. Aristotle calls these useful activities that have the capacity, we have the ability to do them faster or slower, and that's a meaningful thing to say about them. Those are called kinetic activities. And the ones where it's ridiculous to say, can you enjoy that violin concerto more efficiently? Where that makes no sense, Aristotle will call those entelecheic, meaning the whole point of it is enjoyed from the very beginning through to the end, such that getting it over with makes no sense. Like, are you done? Are you done enjoying? Okay. Number one, there are tools that need our guidance versus those that have some automaticity to them. And the latter are frequently called machines. An example of a tool that needs our guidance, a wooden spoon. As soon as you stop using the spoon to stir, it stops stirring. It has no independence from you. It requires your constant guidance. The washing machine, on the other hand, you press a button, and if you have one of the kinds like we have at our convent in DC, it sings to you. So it rewards you for pressing the button. But then you walk along your way and it washes your clothes. Oh, all you had to do was press the button. So contrast the washing machine, which continues to do its thing, with the wooden spoon, which is just, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't even sing to you. All right. So the tools that I am most interested in are what I'm calling technocratic tools. Technocratic tools are those that are designed for efficiency and ease. That's to say, for saving time and energy. This means technocratic tools are designed to assist us in kinetic or task activities, wherein being efficient makes sense. They're useless when it comes to what we might call entertainment activities or entelecheic activities. You should note that because technocratic tools are designed for efficiency and ease, the choice to use a technocratic tool is a choice for efficiency and ease. And here are two distinctions that I want to make regarding the word technocratic. A technocratic age, which is a phrase that's in the title of this talk, is an age that is dominated by technocratic tools. They say an age is dominated by technocratic tools if it's impossible to be part of the culture without using these tools, such that the choice not to use these tools that make us more efficient and allow us to live with greater ease is a choice to be weird. and isolated. That's to say, isolated from other tool users. In a technocratic age, the use of technocratic tools becomes the object of our striving. In other words, it becomes, in some respects, the goal of the culture. A second clarification is that we can use tools technocratically when we use them just for this purpose, namely for ease and for efficiency. So I'll use the phrase, the technocratic use of a technocratic tool as the ultimate, that's the ultimate target of this talk. So when we use a technocratic tool without reflecting on why we are seeking efficiency and why we're seeking ease, that is a technocratic use of a technocratic tool. Why do they help us to be more efficient, and why do they increase ease? Technocratic tools do for us either some or all of the cognitive activities that are involved in choosing. They relieve us of the obligation to notice, to remember, to imagine, and to judge. The way that a smart device does this is obvious, so I'll stick to the washing machine. If we use a washing machine, we don't have to notice where our clothes are dirty. We don't have to remember where we've already scrubbed. We don't have to judge whether we've scrubbed enough. All we have to do is notice that we need to put the garment into the machine. That's not a, I know you're not going to necessarily stop using washing machines because of that. Unnatural dramatic pause here. but here's something dramatic. What's most important isn't just what technocratic tools do for us, it's what they don't do. They don't tell us why we are saving time and energy. They offer us the possibility of removing or extending a natural limit, but they don't give us a reason for why the limit should be removed. The removal of limits is the unquestioned highest principle of technocracy. Doing things efficiently and easily is always good. Notice whether you have bought into that principle. Part three. How does our use of technocratic tools affect our capacity to exercise the activities that are crucial to wisdom? There's a general principle operative here, which is unless you use it, you lose it. Our psychological capacities, this is to say, atrophy when we cease to exercise them. This is obvious to us on the physical level. And if it's not, look at the movie WALL-E. For those of you who haven't watched that or watched it recently, there are human beings who have presumably lived many decades or perhaps their whole life in a spaceship, wherein in order to keep them kind of pacified, technology does everything for them, and they're morbidly obese, so much so that none of their bones connect to each other because they've never really like stood up on their legs. So it's obvious to us on the physical level that when we don't use something, it atrophies. It's not so obvious to us, though, on a cognitive level. And just two preliminary comments about atrophy as an effect of the use of technocratic tools. Atrophy in itself isn't always bad. It's okay for some activities, some abilities you have to atrophy. So for example, if you knew how to text on a BlackBerry, that's a skill that you can let atrophy. In the convent in Nashville, we have an organ from 1888, I think, and it is really charming. It has, on the floor below the organ, there's a billow, billows, yeah. Okay, so I don't know how to use the billows to get the air to the organ for the sister who's playing it up above, But since we now have a different organ as well, that's an activity that, at least in theory, we can allow to atrophy. So atrophy in itself isn't always bad. It's important for us to ask, though, whether the activities that are atrophying are worth keeping around. Another preliminary comment is that some of the effects that flow from our use of technocratic tools aren't themselves just atrophy, but they are downstream from atrophy. So that's to say, there are some things that atrophy, and then there are kind of downstream effects of that. So here are a list of effects that happen to our ability to become speculatively wise when we use technocratic tools technocratically. Recall, as a setup for this, that in olden days, the way that we came to have a vision of the whole and of how the parts fit in with the whole was to make distinctions. And we made distinctions. I say this, olden days, like this might have been just yesterday that you did this, but before technocratic tools really ruled our lives, the ordinary way that distinctions were just came about was that you would see things together. You notice one thing, you notice another, and you bring them together. So you use your memory, you use your imagination and your ability to attend to the present, and you somehow bring all those things together across time, and you notice commonalities and differences. The philosophical word for this is induction, when you notice commonalities that are present in multiple instances. Okay, when we use technocratic tools technocratically, this inclines us to, first, to stop seeing connections. Why? We stop seeing because we stop looking for them. We stop looking because the machines do it for us. Number two, we start paying attention to the technology rather than to the things that the technology is processing. When I was driving here, I caught myself multiple times paying attention to the GPS rather than to the road. Has that happened to any of you? This is really frightening, especially when I'm going 76 miles an hour. And then I realize, oh, and the reason why I know I'm going 76 miles an hour is because the phone is telling me that. Oh. So our attention is fixed on the technology rather than on the things that the technology is pointed at, as it were. A third effect with regard to our ability to become speculatively wise, we stop noticing or engaging with other activities that the tools can't register. So consider what you had to do before the internet came along if you wanted to know how to cut up a leg of venison for a barbecue. So you have the leg in front of you. You don't know what to do. So if you can't go to the internet, what do you have to do? You have to figure out exactly what question are you going to ask. Then you have to figure out, generally speaking, who is someone that knows about this stuff. Then you have to figure out whether it's worth the inconvenience for you and that other person to ask the question. And then when you say yes, you have to go and you probably have to endure a whole bunch of stories before you get the answer you were looking for. Which means that you had to sort through what's relevant and what's irrelevant. Okay, so that's the olden way of doing it. What have we done? Now that we have YouTube, WikiHow, ChatGPT, any of this, Google, we have stopped asking the questions that these technologies can't answer. We ask the questions in a way that we will get an answer. Conversely, we end up noticing things that we know our technology can handle. In Washington, D.C., where I teach, there are motorized scooters that are delivering things. I don't know, like, I don't know if it's DoorDash. Is this, again, my news fast means I really don't know what they're doing. But what I do know is that they have an uncanny ability to identify 16 inches. That is often between a car and another car, or a car and a pedestrian, through which their particular piece of technology can fit. And that's the only thing that they see. So this is our vision, the way that we ask questions, what we notice, what registers to us is what registers to the tool. Fourth effect for use of technocratic tools on our ability to become speculatively wise is that we start to understand things only in relation to technology. What I mean by understand here is very loosely seeing something in relation to basic elements of our experience. What is basic to us are images and words. The more that we use technology, the more basic to us the technology becomes. This is to say, the images and the words through which we view life are increasingly technological rather than natural. Even in this talk, I've used the word lens. Did I use the word rigged? No. Changing gears? It's not quite technocratic. But other words that are used very frequently, connection, plugged in, click, all these are technical tools or technical words that we use to describe our own natural processes. Having technological or artificial images and words isn't concerning in its own right, but it is concerning at least for two reasons. One is that if the images and the words that are basic to us are artificial, this means that they're from someone else. Artifice is a creation of another person. So the images that we are using as fundamental to us are actually the images that are the making of another person. So in some respects, other people are inside our heads, giving us the foundation for our judgments. Another reason to be concerned about artificial images, something like this, that if these images or these words are basic for us, we don't have anything more basic with which to judge them. So not only are they not ours, fundamentally, but also we have no way of evaluating whether they're good or bad unless we have something even more basic. So in anticipation of the final section of this talk, where I'll give some suggestions, I'd say this. Avoid what I'll call antecedent use of technology, which would be don't go to technology for the sake of inspiration. You can use technology consequent, in other words, after you have an image, after you have a sense of what you wish to do, go get the tool that will make that happen. But don't look to the tool to give you the vision. Okay, stepping back away from that advice, just to what are the effects of using technological tools on our becoming practically wise? So up to this point, I've been focusing on speculative wisdom. Once again, start off with in the olden days. There was a particular order and even a particular rhythm to the kinds of activities that we chose to do. Aristotle's way of distinguishing these activities is it's a threefold distinction. We'll say there are end goals that we have that are not desirable in themselves. We only desire them for the sake of something else. And he'll call these instrumental, merely instrumental ends. An example of this would be flossing. If you enjoy flossing just for the sake of flossing, you are very weird. It's okay to enjoy flossing, but the reason why you enjoy it is because of what it brings about in you. So you enjoy it because of what it leads to. Other end goals or other goals we have are things that you can enjoy them. It makes sense to enjoy them for their own sake, but they're also things that lead to other more delightful things. So we can call these intermediate goals. So you have merely instrumental goals that are desirable only for something else. Then you have things that are desirable maybe for something else, but they're also enjoyable for their own sake. So having a nice smile. Or good oral hygiene. How's about that? Having good oral hygiene, yes, it's desirable in its own right. But also you desire it for the sake of overall being healthy. So you have intermediate goals. And then finally, we have goals that for which it makes no sense to say that we desire that for something else. And these we can call final or chief goals. A biblical presentation of this is something like this. For 6 days out of the week, we aim at instrumental and intermediate goals. For 6 days out of the week, we do things that are orienting to something that we will enjoy just for its own sake. But we spend 6 days working. We can enjoy the work because there's some pleasure in accomplishing things. We can enjoy the work. So it doesn't mean for 6 days you live in misery. Just for, you know. No, you enjoy an activity that is working. An activity that isn't good for its own sake. It's good because of what it leads to, namely the seventh day on which you rest. So on the seventh day, you also enjoy. It's not that the enjoyment is just attending to the work, but the rest is enjoyable for a different reason than the working is enjoyable. Okay. I set this up as a background for talking about what the use of technocratic tools does to that dynamic. Technocratic tools are aimed at making us do these intermediate activities more efficiently and easier. Technocratic tools try to give us more time in theory, for these final ends. In theory. Theory and reality don't always match. In reality, technocratic tools, or the technocratic use of technocratic tools, inclines us to, number one, stop wishing. We often stop wishing even for that final end. Why? Technocratic tools present us with a superabundance of possibilities of what we could do. It's to say, the technology does for us the work of noticing something that we don't have but could have. Technology also doesn't give us the space to work up our appetite for the things we don't have. Why? Because it provides the thing before we can wish for it. It's almost like it pushes back on the delight of anticipation. A movie much older than WALL-E, the Music Man, there's a scene where the Wells Fargo wagon is coming into town. This was the before Amazon. And there's a song wherein everyone in the town is anticipating what the Wells Fargo wagon is going to bring them. The Wells Fargo wagon is a coming down the street. Oh, please let it be for me. So there's this anticipation, and the anticipation itself is delightful. Contrast that with Amazon, whose latest little ditty on their driving machines, their trucks, is is now a good time. Meaning, you can order it and it arrives before you order it, like almost. I think there's an option now for, I want it in 3 hours, something like that. So we stop wishing because our ability to anticipate is almost, we're deprived of that. Also, on my drive here, I was behind an 18-wheeler, and again, going 76 miles an hour, on a 5% downgrade, and I almost used the phone to take a picture of the back of the truck. I thought, that is foolish. But here's why. It was a Sheetz truck. And on the back, there's a picture of an ecstatic guy holding a Frappuccino with a speech bubble above him saying, I don't even have to think. The app knows what I like. Ah! Wow. Okay, you don't even need to wish. Second effect of technocratic use of technocratic tools on our ability to be practically wise, where it inclines us to stop deliberating. Why? Technology does for us the work of noticing possibilities and also of judging those possibilities in light of principles. But the principle that technocratic tools applies to each of the possibilities is how much time does it take and how much will it cost? So the rule, the should and the shouldn't, that technocratic tools provide for all of our means is you shouldn't spend more money and you shouldn't spend more time. No more comparison. That becomes an absolute. I'm not saying that this is something that's brought into our lives because of smartphones or anything like that. By no means. But in the past, we took time and cost into account, but hopefully we didn't do that first. And also, we didn't do that alone. Okay, another thing that technocratic use of technocratic tools does is it inclines us to judge, to say, to perceive the world differently. We begin to evaluate things quantitatively and to ignore quality. I've already mentioned this in the previous effect, but our view of time has been shifted by our use of tools. We begin to judge the value of activities in terms of the time that they take. This is an abstract quantitative measure. In other words, we're just counting. We judge activities in terms of the time it takes rather than judging the value of time in terms of the activities that it enables. Rather than asking, is this worth doing? We ask, how long will it take? I think this is so deeply in us that it's even hard to wrap our minds around what the difference is. So here's two examples. We can either say that dinner time is at 6 o'clock. That's an abstract quantitative measure. Or you can say dinner is when mom has finished making it. Or back in Connecticut, when the fireflies come out, that's dinner time. All right. That's a qualitative measure of time. Another example, on a recent trip, I had a stop through at an airport that is renowned for delays. So I had planned for a delay. I had planned for about 2 hours of delay. And I was okay with the delay because I had marked it off in my mind as this is travel time. So it was all right. I noticed that it was a 2-hour delay, but when it hit to be, well, I won't tell you how long it actually was, but I started to be upset and anxious when the time ceased to be travel time and started to be sleep time. 5 hours. Oh, don't go through Fort Worth. All right. Another just example of quantitative measurement as kind of pushing out qualitative measurement. Also on my drive here, I walked by a soda vending machine at which right above where you put your money in, it says count, then choose. And it wasn't talking about the money, it's talking about calories. So if you think of why is it that we choose the foods that we choose? Increasingly, we choose foods because we are looking at something that we're counting. We're looking at the macronutrients, the micronutrients, or we're just reducing it to caloric intake. What about saying, why are you eating that? Well, because someone served it to me. How's about that? Regardless of how many calories it is. Or why are you eating that? Because I'm hungry. That's a qualitative measure. I'm hungry. As opposed to something like, well, my daily caloric expenditure is 100 calories, about 17,000. No, okay. So in other words, we can view time, food, and then even money in a merely qualitative, quantitative manner. Another effect, fourth effect, and there are six so that you can count down. We are inclined to be driven not so much by desire as by fear. And how does this happen? Well, because we can move faster, more efficiently, we feel that we should be doing things more efficiently. Or rather, we feel that we should be doing more things, quantitatively more things, because we can. We can push back on this should, but that requires saying, why should I be doing more things? Is it even the case that I should be, is it the case that I should be doing things more efficiently? Should I use the washing machine so I have more time to pray? Maybe not. Maybe you can pray when you're washing your clothes by hand. Maybe. Maybe work and prayer aren't at odds in the way that we assume they are when we justify using technocratic tools technocratically. Being driven by fear is also, it's something like this, I think, is operative, where we feel obliged to continue to work because since the tools have relieved us of a lot of the difficulty of working, we feel as though we need to earn the right to rest. I don't know if there's such a thing as like a virtuous busyness, but I've noticed on collegiate campuses, including in myself, something like this, where we almost brag about being so busy as though it's a virtuous thing, like I'm so busy. And we don't use it just for as an excuse, but it's kind of like we can justify taking a rest only when we feel so busy, only when we feel exhausted, to the point where we might actually have to do things really efficiently so we can fit in a sufficient number of exhausting things to exhaust us so we can rest. Huh. Okay. Fifth effect. Technocratic use of technocratic tools inclines us to be more passive in spite of our being more productive. We use less of our agency. We notice less, wish less, deliberate less, judge less, and we command less. As a consequence, also, we are less satisfied with our actions because our own agency isn't as involved. This leaves us more vulnerable, by the way, to what I'm calling easy satisfaction. Because we feel more passive, we don't feel the gratification of using our agency. What we look for, what we're really looking for, is something meaningful. But we easily mistake pleasure for meaning. So we binge Netflix because we want something gratifying, something that we're not getting from just using tools. Number six, and the last of the effects. Our use of tools technocratically inclines us to engage less with others in spite of appearing to do things in common. The more we recognize that technology can replace us in basic activities, and the more this becomes accepted in culture, the more we don't even consider showing up. If grandma has an Alexa, I know there's a Saturday Night Live clip a while ago featuring, was Alexa Silver, something like this? Okay. So this, if you have an older person who's not yet in a nursing home but is lonely, oh, well then the older person starts shouting at Alexa or Odessa or whatever. Okay. And we laugh at the skit, but the thing that's not laughable is that it's become an excuse for us that we don't show up, we don't call our grandma, or we text her rather than seeing her, because the technology is there to replace our very, well, inconvenient interaction. There's a book by Eric Brendy. He lived with a Mennonite community for 18 months, and one of his observations was this. The Mennonite community rejects lightning rods. Why? Well, because if you use a lightning rod, then not as many barns will burn down. And if not as many barns burn down, then you won't have as many barn raisings. And if you don't have barn raisings, then you won't have communal activity. You won't have an activity that needs 18 able-bodied men. Our use of technocratic tools has left us isolated. And we haven't noticed it because we have considered doing things with other people as doing it in their physical presence. Notice, by the way, that there's actually a quantitative reduction of what it means to be with. We've reduced it to physical withing, but also it's kind of like, well, I'm with you. I'm this far away from you. Or even we've reduced being with someone to just doing the same thing. So watching the same movie, each of us on our own personal devices, which happens on the plane, like, oh, goodness, everyone has their own personal device. Are you doing the same? Are you with these people? No. It's what in education is called parallel play. But it's not with the other person. So, part four. What can we do if we wish to avoid these effects? Three options. you can, well, maybe this isn't an option to avoid the effects, but you can just give up on wisdom. That's easy. You could give up on tools. That's not easy. I cheer anyone who tries to do that, to be a teetotaler, but most of us are too weak for this to be a realistic option. So the third option that all of us knew from the very beginning of this is we have to figure out how can we use tools in such a way that it won't destroy our ability to perform these activities that I've mentioned. How do we do that? Three suggestions. Stop using technology unreflectively. Reflect on what you're using it for. Why are you bothering to save time and energy? Reflect on how the tool works. What activity of your own are you relegating to the tool? Reflect on the tool's effect on your agency. Notice it. Second recommendation, start looking for people who are willing to ask the same questions that you're asking. Look for people who are willing to think through some possibilities for living differently. To think through it with you. It doesn't mean look for the person who has the solution, and it also doesn't mean find the solution and then go tell it to someone else. Do a barn-raising sort of thinking through. This is a problem that requires more than just you. And if I might say, you can't do it alone. When you find these people, have a conversation that's messy, where you haven't made the decision yet. Be with the other person in that messiness. Figure out what you can do first, how to work together, the 6 days of work. It's really awkward to say, will you just be with me? Say, how's about we do this thing together? Which means that you're not doing something physically, both of you with your earbuds, ear pods, I don't know, what are their earplugs? Like, you're not plugged in. You're with the other person, not just parallel play, but working together. Then you can work up to resting with the other person, doing something that is enjoyable just for its own sake with the other person. And then third recommendation is to start contemplating. What I mean by contemplation is resting your mind on something wherein your desire is also at rest. Rest, don't think about the thing, just think of the thing in such a way that you enjoy it and just allow that enjoyment to wash over you. That is the thing for which efficiency and ease makes no sense. And the more that you contemplate in this manner, the more it will increase your appetite for it. A concluding remark is that these three remedies that I've just mentioned sound suspiciously familiar to pray, fast, and give alms. So pray, contemplate, fast, push back on the drive for ease, and give alms. Push back on the drive for the efficiency and meaninglessness that we can achieve when we're not with others. Perhaps it isn't surprising then that the remedies for our technocratic use of technocratic tools have actually been there all along, the perennial wisdom of those who sought wisdom. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.